the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, one man on a winning streak in the business world is Nick Keegan, whose company Mail Metrics is delivering results and expanding at quite a pace. But going back to his early years, Nick's future was far from sealed. A bit of a dosser at school, he was rejected for his dream career in the army. Fast forward to today, and Nick employs 150 staff, has offices in a number of places, including Poland and the UK, and has plans for further expansion into the US. Nick Keegan, you're very welcome. The company today has grown, particularly in the last few years, with €40 million in revenue. But it wasn't always like that. Tell me a bit about how you got the original idea for the business. It was originally called Green Letterbox, wasn't it?
Yes, terrible name, but we kind of picked it and it stuck for some reason. But yeah, so it was originally Green Letterbox. What we were trying to do was build a consumer app to make it easier to manage your household bills and statements. So you'd have one place on your phone where you could receive and store your bank statements, your utility bills, telephone bills, revenue correspondence, all of this, you know, all these communications that you get from your various service providers. And we were trying to consolidate that into one easy to use location on your phone.
And how did it go?
It went absolutely terribly. So I was 24 when I started the business. So it was back in 2013. Basically, we went out and raised €700,000 in seed funding and somehow managed to convince people to give us €700,000, and we had absolutely no experience. And we quickly realised that the business idea was flawed. And when we actually went and started talking to customers, nobody really wanted to use the product, because it was a two-sided business model where you needed users, which were people like myself and yourself, who, you know, have to manage your household bills and statements. And then you had the senders of those documents, so the banks, the insurance companies, the utilities, and they were actually our customers. And they didn't want their customers going to our consolidated app. They wanted their customers going to their website where they could upsell them and cross-sell them.
So you set up the business, you got a good level of investor backing and funding, and you launched it probably full of optimism, full of hope. And what happened then?
Yeah, we launched it to great fanfare. We thought this was going to be a game-changing idea, anticipating the tsunami of new users that we were going to have. We set up an email notification that would come out every morning, which would, you know, tell us how many users had signed up the day before. So the day after going live, we were waiting for this email to come in and no users had signed up. And so, of course, what we did first is we went to check to make sure, because we thought this email notification was broke, but in fact, just nobody signed up. And we were 3 years then without ever raising a single invoice, you know.
3 years?
3 years.
How did you manage to keep going financially as well as mentally, psychologically?
Well, we had raised the 700,000, so we had a bit of cash in the bank, but like we had a team of 7 or 8 people at the time. But every month you would see the bank balance go down and go down and go down. So effectively what we had to do was just let everybody go. So it was myself, my two co-founders, and we kept one software developer. We closed our office. We had an office in Poland because my two business partners are from Poland, and that's where our dev team was. So we let everybody go. We got rid of our office and we rented a very dingy apartment and based ourselves out of there. And to be honest, it was a pretty rough time, because you launch the business with great hopes and aspirations and you get a bit of publicity and you
reckon it's going to be huge and this is it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny when you look back at our financial projections for where we would be after 6 months and 12 months, like we were going to be absolutely rolling in it. And, you know, the reality couldn't have been further from the truth.
Was it demoralizing? I mean, it must have dented your confidence as well.
Absolutely. Because you know, we were kind of playing the startup game as opposed to trying to build an actual business. So we were focused on raising money, you know, trying to raise a big investment round, going to all the startup events, pitching, as opposed to actually going to find a customer. And as you're going through that process of going to all these various different events, you're seeing other startups that started at the same time as you, and at least from the outside looking in, you know, they're knocking it out of the park. And you look at, you know, yourself and your own business, and it's just not going very well at all. And our big fear was that we were going to burn through all the cash and go out of business without ever having you know, raised a single euro of an invoice.
Sleepless nights?
Sleepless nights, yeah, sleepless nights. And then we, you know, we were trying to think all the time, we need to pivot, like we need to change the business model. And there was a lot of disagreements of which way we should go. We couldn't really find an idea that we could all agree on. So we were trying lots of different things over that 3-year period to just find something that would stick, you know.
And it must have been, I mean, you got rid of the office, you had to let staff go, you're in a sort of an apartment or whatever it is, you're based there, you've got your colleagues as well, and in Poland, and nothing is happening. People would say it's great when you start out in business to have perseverance and to keep going and not give up. But then others would say there comes a point where you have to say, this isn't working, I need to stop and go off and do something else.
Mm.
But you didn't, and it came good in the end.
Yeah, like when you say there was nothing to do, there was literally nothing to do. Like I'd come into the office because I had a little one-person office. We were based in Ballymun at the time, and you'd come into the office on a Monday and a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and you'd have nothing to do. Like there'd be no emails coming in because you've no customers, you know. But I'd like to say that it was some dogged determination that we just decided to keep going, and one day we knew this would come good. But the reality was we'd raised a bit of money. We didn't have a huge amount of other options. Like I could have went and got a job somewhere, but I didn't have, you know, much experience outside of, you know, outside of college. So we had money in the bank and we just said, we'll just keep going because we have the cash there and we'll just keep trying different things until we figure something out.
So what turned it around?
A bit of good luck. So one day my phone rang and it was an insurance company that we had pitched the Green Letterbox idea to maybe a year prior. And they kind of didn't really remember what we did, but they knew that we were selling something got to do with, you know, digitizing bills and statements. And they said that they have a tender coming out. They basically have a mail room in their office where they're printing and mailing millions of letters every year out to their policyholders. So your renewal notice and claims notices and so on. It was very manual. There were stuffing these envelopes by hand and they were making lots of errors, which was causing them regulatory issues. And they wanted to outsource that problem to somebody else. And then in phase two, they wanted to stop sending letters and they wanted to send all those documents securely, electronically. And they said, is that what you guys do? Would you like to be involved in the tender? And sure, I said, that's exactly what we do. And
did you? You say you just went for it.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we do. And that we pivoted in that direction on the back of that phone call because, you know, it was light at the end of the tunnel. It was a potential customer willing to pay us for anything. And we would
that could have been risky though, Nick, because you'd say, oh, absolutely, that's what we do. And then he'd say, well, who do you do it for?
Yeah, but you cross that bridge when you come to it, you know. And so it was a relatively small opportunity in the grand scheme of things. But for us, it was a lifeline. And because we were pretty close to running out of cash, like we had maybe 6 months of runway left before the bank balance went to zero. And the way we structured it was we needed a partner because we were going to do all the digital communications. We needed a partner to do the print communications. So we partnered up with a printing business that were going to print and mail the letters and we were going to do the digital correspondence. And based on that joint response, we won the tender. We leveraged our partner's experience and the other companies they worked with to get around the problem of, you know, we've never actually done this before.
So that was a big break in redefining and changing the company and what you did. But I'd imagine that you still, any company in that kind of area would still have the same issue, which is that a large insurance company or a bank, you know, before they would hand over access to their customer database, they'd say, well, who are you?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're naturally going to look towards bigger businesses. Was that a problem?
It was. And that's why we had to go down the partnership route. As it turns out, my father is a shareholder in that business. So we had some understanding of how all this worked. And that's so we leveraged that relationship to say, well, they're actually going to be the lead party on the contract and we're going to be the technology provider that is subcontracted in.
And they were known and they had a track record and so that...
Yeah, they had a balance sheet and they had customers and they had a track record and so we were able to partner with that business and we provide the technology, they provide like the kind of strong balance sheet and the customer references. And then after a couple of wins with that model, we were big enough that we could, you know, we could go for these opportunities alone.
And what you've done more recently then is you've actually acquired other businesses, which has helped you to get access to and a good relationship with big clients.
Yeah, so as you rightly pointed out, we're processing the most sensitive of customer data. You know, regulatory approvals needed by the central bank in Ireland and other kind of financial regulators in other countries. It's a very complex area. They're very complex projects to run in many cases. So the customers don't tend to change supplier very often. And it can be a challenge for new business growth because there needs to be a really big pain point for a bank to move its customer communication supplier. So based on our history of having partnered with a printing business to fulfill certain elements of the contracts that we were winning, we recognise that these printing businesses have a lot of the customers that we want to send digital communications for, but they just happen to be sending printed letters for them. So we thought, well, maybe if we start buying these printing businesses, we can then go to their customers and say, you're currently spending €1 million a year printing and mailing letters to your customers. We have a digital solution that will help you to you know, reduce that down by 50 or 70%.
And when you were growing up and thinking about where some of those personality traits and entrepreneurship comes from, you grew up in Dublin, you in Drumcondra?
Yeah, so I was born in Coolock initially, spent only a very early couple of years of my life there, but really Drumcondra is home. You know, grew up in Drumcondra most of my life.
And you were very interested in the early days in joining the Defence Forces. That's really what you wanted to do.
Yeah, so my father was in the Defence Forces. His brother, my uncle, was also in the Defence Forces. And as you're a young lad growing up, and you find the uniforms in the attic, you know, and you start playing around with those and all the old equipment, I think that's where my interest first, you know, got piqued when I joined the Defence Forces. And then over the years, that solidified and it was something that I really wanted to do as a career.
And that wasn't easy because you wanted to get a cadetship. There's only a certain number of cadetships and it's difficult to get through the process. And you were struggling to manage that.
At the best of times, prior to the crash, 400 applicants would apply a year for maybe 40 positions. But then after the crash, there was 5,000 people applying for 20 places. And so the odds very quickly get, you know, very much stacked against you.
So you would have applied for a number of times. Many times did you apply?
I think it was 4 or 5 times. I can't really remember, but it's around 4 or 5 times. So it was a good, you know, a good 4 or 5 years where you're almost putting your life on hold because you want... you're waiting for the next application round to open up.
So what kind of jobs did you do while you were waiting for the next round of applications?
The only other job really I had outside of this is I worked in a pet shop in Ballymun, which is where I learned my trade, let's say. So that was an interesting gig, which didn't work out very well.
That sounds like it ended badly, did it?
Well, I don't say it ended badly, but let's just say I got sacked. So I suppose that's as bad as it could end. That's as bad as it could go, I suppose. But
right.
It was more so that I just wasn't very interested in it. And whilst I was applying to join the army, I had actually joined the Reserve Defence Forces. So I joined the Reserve Defence Forces when I was 17 and spent 11 years in the Reserve Defence Forces ultimately. So I did kind of scratch that itch and I did become an officer in the Reserve Defence Forces.
But, and your dad had been in the Defence Forces, but was he interested in making a bit of money and was there a bit of business sort of running through his veins?
Yeah, he's a very successful entrepreneur in his own right. So when he left the Defence Forces, started out like newspaper rounds and selling sandwiches and so on out of the back of a van around the business parks in the north side of Dublin, then went on to create his first probably real success, which was a Christmas hampers business. You know, they'd knock around door to door and you'd pay on the drip every week until you got your Christmas hamper at Christmas. And he sold that business and, you know, went on then to like frozen foods and ultimately then he got into the printing business, security printing, and, you know, that's probably where he spent most of his career.
And did you work with him in any of those ventures?
Yeah, we would have worked in his we would have worked in his factory during summers and so on. And I'd remember when we were kids. Yeah, I also had a newsagent and a toy shop on I think it was Abbey Street in town. So you remember all those things as you're growing up.
He really had a lot of different businesses.
Yeah, he tried. He tried lots of different things. Some of them were successful, some of them less so. But in general, he's had a couple of nice wins over the years.
What about the future for Mail Metrics? You have clients in Ireland. Are you looking at internationally?
Yeah, so we have we acquired a business in the UK also. So our clients are across UK and Ireland. We are now very much looking to expand into the US and in Western Europe.
Since 2013, just to put it in perspective, how much has the business grown?
Well, we're kind of a 10-year overnight success, I think, because the first 3 years we had no customers, no revenue. We won our first contract like the very back end of the third year. And then we started to grow at a rate of maybe 40% a year organically. But it was from a very low base. So it was only in 2019 that we did our first million in revenue. So it took us 7 years to get to a million in annual revenue, which is very, very slow growth by all accounts. Since 2019, the business has just scaled rapidly. You know, like it was 2 million the following year. I think it was 14 million the following year, 20 the next year, and so on and so forth. And we continue on that trajectory. We always like to say there's good problems and there's bad problems. Like problems with scaling your business are good problems. Problems like having no customers are bad problems. So they're the kind of problems we're happy to have.
Going back to school days, leaving cert, were you much engaged with that? Did you study hard?
No, I don't think anybody could say I studied hard. I was probably I'm very capable, but just very disinterested. So I was never the academic type. Didn't do a very good leaving cert, probably much to my parents' frustration. I did go on to college, but again, as a means to an end, because I thought it would help me to get into an army cadetship, but kind of did the minimum to pass the exams. I just had no interest in being there at all, you know.
And when you decided that the best way forward for the business was to buy other businesses, like printing businesses and so forth, obviously you'd never acquired a business before. Did you know where to start?
You know where to start. You go to Google and you type in how to buy a business, and that's as simple as it is.
And that's what you did.
That's 100%. Like, I'm not even joking. So you go, how do you buy a business? And it's, well, businesses are valued in as a multiple of EBITDA. And so I'm scratching my head, saying, what's EBITDA? You know, so you're googling what is EBITDA, and then it gives you the definition, and I'm still none the wiser. So I thought to myself, I need to go here and maybe do a course in finance or something. And so I was looking online for a course, and you find a corporate finance course for 6 weeks. I was like, oh God, I can't sit in a classroom for 6 weeks and do a corporate finance course. So probably the best 60 or 70 euros I ever spent, I went on to grinds.ie. It's like, or something along the lines of that, where it's a website where they give grinds to, you know, school and college students. And I basically approached a couple of accountancy grinds to say, look, this is what I'm trying to do. You know, I'm trying to buy a business and I don't understand the basics of some of these terms. Can you give me a couple of hours of your time? And sure, most of them told me to get lost. You know, that's not what they do at all. We give grinds to leaving cert students. But one lad, a Filipino guy, said, look, no problem. If you're going to pay me, I'll meet you. So I spent 2 hours in his apartment, and I brought my accounts, my competitors' accounts, the accounts of the companies I wanted to buy. And I basically just said, just like, walk me through this. Help me to compare one against the other. Tell me what EBITDA is, why it's important. And after a 2-hour crash course, so we were away in a hack, like you have the very basics where you feel like you're not a spoofer when you're throwing these terms around, you know.
And how much did that cost you?
About 60 or 70 quid, I think it was.
And when you look back, are you glad you didn't make the Defence Forces in the end fully?
Oh, look, 100%. It's funny how these things turn out. 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if you had have asked me, or if you had have told me that I wouldn't have gone down that route, I just couldn't have seen myself doing anything else. And looking back now, I think I probably would have scratched the itch and then very quickly become disenfranchised with it. When I look at it now, I think actually what was appealing about it was more so how difficult it was to get in. I liked the challenge of that. I was kind of recognising that in myself now. I liked the idea of setting this goal of getting into this cadetship competition that was, not very easy. It was very selective. But I think once I got in, I probably would have spent a number of years there and been very happy, I'm sure, but then moved on to other things.
Well, and I'm sure the 150 employees you have now are happy as well. Nick Keegan, CEO and founder of Mailmetrics, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.